Okay, you're tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM in Chicago. You're now listening to the Sitting in the Park show. Today, for most of this show, I'm going to be doing an interview with Eugene Phillips, who is here right now. You want to say hi?
Yes, how are you?
So Eugene was in a group, and then he wrote and produced a lot of records, and they're all really excellent material, which we'll also be playing throughout the show. So you should definitely listen. He has an interesting story, and there's some excellent records we'll be playing. So, again, I said your name was Eugene Phillips.
Yeah.
So, first of all, the group that you actually sang in was a group called The Moments of Truth.
Yes, I sang with The Moments of Truth, and actually Wind. I was the lead singer with Wind, and, I also led with The Moments of Truth as well.
And I guess we'll be finding out, but you wrote for a bunch of groups. The main groups were called The Answers and The New Sound.
Right.
So let's get started actually talking about you. So you're the first thing you did, you were actually in a singing group.
Yes.
So how'd you get started singing?
Well, like most groups or most young guys who grew up in the south end of Chicago, you know, singing in the hallways and the restrooms and started practicing in the garages and front rooms of guys' houses, and all of a sudden we became pretty decent.
So were you in a group when you were in high school, or?
No, I wasn't. After I
are you from the south side of Chicago?
I was born in Chicago, raised in Robbins, Illinois.
Okay. And you went to high school in Robbins?
I went to high school at Eisenhower and Thomas J. Keller. And actually, Lincoln Memorial, when it was a school, anyone who lives in Robbins knows that Lincoln Memorial is I think it's not HUD, Department of Human Service building now, but it was a grade school at that time.
Okay.
And I attended there when it was a grade school.
Okay, and but when you were in school, did you sing at all?
The first time I sang was in the seventh grade. My music teacher had me do a Thanksgiving play, that's the first time I ever sang in my life in the public, and scared me half to death. And I didn't know why she selected me out of the whole class to lead this particular song, and I was frightened. But that's the first time, Miss Moody, she thought I could sing.
Okay, so you weren't one of those people who were singing since they were a little kid in church and stuff.
So then
the actual group, what's the story? How did you form the group, The Moments of Truth?
The Moments of Truth came about as a result of actually an attempt to form a record company, which wasn't successful at that time. Ultimately, we ended up releasing that record on our own anyway. But we ran into a manager. One of the guys, it's an interesting story here. One of the guys, a gentleman by the name of Eric Perkins, was a cab driver. And I was a cab driver as well. And this is another story.
This is The Moments of Truth?
Right.
Not The Wind?
No, this was The Moments of Truth.
So you were a cab driver in the 60s too?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, and what happened? Well, actually, at the time we formed The Moments of Truth, I wasn't driving a cab. I was working another job, but ran into this guy named Eric Perkins, and there was another guy driving a cab with him, who was supposed to be a music person, and George Banks was a gentleman's name. He's deceased at this time, and he claimed that he knew the Impressions, and we're like, okay, well, hey, we need somebody, you know, to help us. And sure enough, Sam Gooden came by my house at 8031 South Union, and he heard the material, and he says, okay, I'll take you guys under my wings. And we started rehearsing at Kurtom, we declined to sign a contract there due to some personal issues with Curtis Mayfield. But other than that, we had a rather amicable relationship with Kurtom. We used to come in after the Five Stair Steps. We would rehearse right after they would conclude their rehearsals.
Okay, well, this Moments of Truth, record was released, though, on Bob Lee's label.
That record initially was cut independently. George Banks and some guys, we added up, and we put our money together, and we recorded that record, part of it, in Harvey, Illinois. And the vocals initially were cut at Paul Serrano's first vocal booth. He had just rehabbed his studio and put in a vocal booth, and we were the first group to use it. And that was really the history behind that particular recording. We started in Harvey, and we finished up at Paul Serrano's.
Okay, well, I want to talk more about it, but I don't want to talk too much without people knowing what we're talking about. So
okay.
I'm going to play the record, and then we can talk some more.
Okay.
So you said that the A side of this record was Come Love.
That was the A side.
And you sing lead on the A side.
Yes.
But first, I think I'll play. I like this side a little bit better.
All right. Well,
this side's called I'll Step Aside.
Right.
So I'll play this side, and we'll talk more. So this is the Moments of Truth with I'll Step Aside. Okay, that was just the Moments of Truth with I'll Step Aside. If you're just tuning in, I am talking to Eugene Phillips, who was a member of that group. So I wanted to back up and actually talk about, I guess, how the group formed and who were the members of the group and how you first got involved with that and stuff.
Well, the lead singer of that particular song was my late, great writing partner and friend, Herbert Cope. Herb and I met during the early 60s.
Okay.
And we had mutual friends who moved from Chicago out to Robbins. And Herb used to come out and visit them. And he was a brilliant writer. And eventually I moved into Chicago.
Okay.
And we got together and we started harmonizing with the gentleman he knew, who became my brother-in-law, Earl Westbrooks. And from that, we formed a group, a very, very tight harmony group. And we ended up using the God-given talent that we had as writers along with the fact that we were very good at harmonizing, and for some reason I was able to arrange music.
So there were three members of the group?
There were five.
Okay, so you already mentioned Herbert Cope, Earl Westbrooks, and you, Eugene Phillips. Who were the other two members of the group?
That was McKinley Hood, a gentleman by the name of McKinley Hood, Mac, we used to call him. Let's see, Eric Perkins. Okay. Let's see. Let me think.
What about Jose? You said.
And Jose Alawumi.
Okay, so that's six.
Well, actually, one of the guys dropped out. I'm trying to remember who it was, because as a matter of fact, when we recorded that particular record, that was Jose Alawumi, Herbert Cope, McKinley Hood, okay, and gentleman who's deceased. I can't even think of his name, as well as I know him. Dyson.
Okay.
Virgil Dyson. Virgil Dyson, who died tragically of carbon monoxide poisoning.
So that's on the record is Virgil Dyson, Jose Alawumi, McKinley Hood, Eugene Phillips, and Herbert Cope. Is that right?
Right.
Okay. And so then the other side was Come Love, and you said that got some play in Chicago, right?
Yes. Herb Kent played Come Love steadily, and it did well on the charts. Unfortunately, again, there's a political situation in which many groups in Chicago found themselves caught in the middle of conflicts with the record company, the record labels, and we were no exception to that rule.
So what was the deal? Like, that record, it got put on a label called Toy, which is one of the labels owned by Bob Lee. Bob Lee, he put out a lot of records in Chicago. He put out The Vows and The Kittens and a lot of groups like that. So what's the story? How did you get hooked up with Bob Lee?
Unfortunately, again, Bob Lee was an acquaintance of our manager, George Banks.
Okay.
Okay, when we left Curtown, we went in and recorded the record, Come Love, and I'll Step Aside, independently.
So that came out after, you recorded it after you left Curtown.
Right.
So originally you were supposed to record on one of the early artists on Curtown Records.
That record was supposed to have been recorded.
And you never signed because of some issues with the contract and stuff.
Right, with Curtis. We couldn't come to grips with some arrangements in the contract.
Okay. So then you got, did your manager take you to Bob Lee after Curtown? Is that what happened?
Yes, that's exactly what happened. Mr. Stevens Foster was the president of Salem Records, and at that time Bob Lee and Mr. Foster were business partners in their label venture. Mr. Foster basically was a gospel label operator, and Bob Lee was the R&B arm of that partnership.
Okay. So you ended up signing with Bob Lee, and he put your record out.
Well, yeah, that we ended up, well, we signed with Mr. Foster. But what ended up happening, again, there was a political situation between Mr. Foster and Bob Lee, of which we were caught in the middle of it. We had signed a contract with Toy Records. Unfortunately, that was an error on the part of, looking in retrospect, of our manager, because we should have signed with Mr. Foster.
Okay.
Okay, however, our manager wasn't acquainted with Mr. Foster, and for some reason he trusted Bob Lee, and he signed, had us sign a contract with Toy Records.
Okay.
And
so you ended up being under contract to him, and so how come he never put anything else out on you?
We refused to sing for him. After Mr. Foster had promoted the record rather well, and it was in record stores all over the place and was selling real well. And after the split between him and Bob Lee, he withdrew his promotion, and just, you know, all the records that were in the pipeline, so to speak, he just let it run dry. He just let the records sell at that time. All of the big record stores had it. And he didn't promote it anymore, because it was like, you know, you're under contract with Bob Lee, and Bob Lee is not a very savory person. And even though there was a major record company on the East Coast, which Mr. Foster never told us, exactly, he hinted that it was RCA, was interested in a record, but we couldn't get a release from Bob Lee.
Okay.
So you
couldn't get a release for Bob Lee. So what happened was, I guess you started writing for other people.
Exactly. So one
of the groups you wrote for immediately after was a group called The Answers, right?
Right. The Answers was the very first group that we produced for outside of ourselves. And that was, at the time, The Answers, well, I'm probably getting ahead of myself, but that was Gerald Bailey, Steve Lucas, Augustus Durr, Joe Counts, and Jimmy Neely.
Okay. And actually, I don't want to, for people who don't know what we're talking about, I'd rather play the record and then talk
more. Right, exactly.
So this is an excellent record you produced on The Answers. This is the B-side of the first record you produced. This track is called What Happened, Girl.
Right.
So I'll play this and we can talk some more. So this is The Answers with What Happened, Girl. Okay, that was just The Answers with their record, What Happened, Girl. Right now we're talking to Eugene Phillips, who wrote and produced that record. So who were the specific members singing on that record, actually?
Well, that particular record consisted of, well, actually only two members were separate from the final answers, and that was Dante Watson and Chester Shipp. Chester went on to sing with another group of
Was it the Classettes, I think, wasn't he?
Yeah, he sung with the Chester sung with the Classettes, and he also sung with New Sound.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So on that record was Dante Watson, Chester Shipp, and who were the other people?
Gerald Bailey and Augustus Durr.
Okay, so there were four people singing.
Right.
On
well,
that.
Actually five because Jimmy Neely was also singing with them. Steve Lucas and Joe Counts were the only two members that weren't.
Okay, so on that record, you wrote and produced it, but you're not sure exactly how it got released, right?
Have a clue.
The record label it's on Crash, which was Al Benson's label, but Al Benson was working with Bob Lee around that time, and it definitely's got Bob Lee's name all over it, but he didn't write it at all.
He didn't have anything to do with that. I don't know how that happened.
He was just your manager at the time,
was just a station. I
he
mean,
was the guy
a,
you were signed
label
to.
Owner. Yeah, that's he wasn't even a producer or a writer or anything. He just owned the label that we were under.
Okay.
You know.
And one thing that's interesting is that the A side of the record is called Things Gonna Get Better Tomorrow.
Right.
It's like kind of a funky, kind of conscious
right, precisely,
type song.
Exactly.
And actually that record was recorded by the Natural Four, actually.
Exactly.
So in the Natural Four interview, I was talking to Chris James in here, and he was talking about how it was Rich Tufo's song, but it's actually it wasn't, right?
Herbert Cope and Gene Phillips wrote that song.
Okay.
Yes, we. As a matter of fact, it was the first song we ever had copyrighted.
Okay, so
and it's the first one we had ripped off too.
So somehow, like Hurtime Records stole the song from
Tufo.
You?
Yes, I don't know how Bob Lee must have sold the song to him,
okay.
But it wasn't his song to sell. But that's what he was notorious for that kind of conduct.
Okay, so. And I'm sure the Chris James and Natural Four didn't know that.
No,
but,
they didn't.
But you know, he assumed that it was Rich Tufo's song.
No,
but
it was.
Actually they stole the song.
They
from
stole
you.
The song.
And I think your version came out first, so
yeah.
I can play.
Yeah.
I'll play it at the end, but it doesn't sound like the Natural Four's version.
No.
So then the Answers released. There was a couple other records that they released. One was As the Answers to Love.
Right.
And one was that you released on your own Scorpion label.
Right.
Do you know which one came out first?
Actually, the first thing we recorded was the one you just played.
Okay.
That was the first one we actually recorded.
Yeah, but which one came out second then?
The second one would be, that was the one that was on MGM.
So that was the one, the Answers to Love record.
Right, the big record with the big symphony orchestra behind it.
Okay, so actually before I ask you this, is how did you get hooked up with this group writing and producing for them?
Well, after we realized that we couldn't record any longer under our real names, we took on pseudonyms, Herbert Cope as Copeland, Herb Copeland, and myself as Eugene Phillips. At the time, we had another writer with us, Bob Black, was a Robert White, really, was his name. And we were actually shopping for a record label to work with.
But, I mean, how did you get involved with the actual group, the Answers?
Well, the Answers was still our group. But it happened, gentleman who's deceased now, Leroy Outlaw, Mr. Leroy Outlaw, which I knew from Robbins, had his son and daughter were musicians, and they were the ones who actually discovered the group that later became the Answers.
Okay.
Because Gus lived across the street from Augustus Durr.
Okay.
And they knew Dante Watson and Chester Shipp.
Okay.
Okay, and Jimmy Neely, basically, Mr. Outlaw was working with them, so they got in contact with me and said, okay, we have a group over here. They knew about my dealing with music.
Okay.
And he asked me if I could come over and do something with them.
Okay.
And I enjoyed it. I liked working with them, so we decided, okay, hey, we can do something. We're going to do things. Things are going to be better tomorrow, and can't you tell me what happened, girl? So we actually did a demo.
Okay.
We actually did a demo, and unfortunately, this was done at Bob Lee. I don't know how Mr. Outlaw became acquainted with Bob Lee.
Okay.
Other than through actually us because of George Banks.
Okay.
And we were looking for someone to pick up a label, and I didn't know Bob's notorious reputation at that time. I really didn't.
Okay.
You know, so Mr. Outlaw ran it out to him, and he says, okay, you know, I can deal with it. Mr. Outlaw's a rather imposing gentleman, well over 6 feet tall, and he's like, okay, you know, he's a gentleman, but he, believe me, if he didn't like a situation, he'd let you know it. And that's what happened with Bob Lee.
Okay, so but then you so then you ended up doing a second Answers record as the Answers to Love,
right,
on Lion Records, which is a division of MGM.
Right.
So how did you get how did that get hooked up?
Well, that's weird because initially we auditioned for Mavis Staples' label, which was directly across.
Are you talking about Stax Records or?
Well, her personally, she had a label on right directly across the street from Giant Records on Cottage Grove.
Okay.
And we auditioned there initially as writers, Herb and myself.
Okay.
Okay. She wanted us to come back. She wanted us to do some more Southern style R&B, which we were opposed to. And we knew about Giant. And even though we said we would come back and bring a tape, we didn't. We went across the street.
Okay.
And there we met Melvin Collins.
Okay.
And we auditioned tapes for Mel Collins, and Mel says, okay, hey, you guys got a job. So I met a guy that I had held in very high esteem, and that was Walter Jackson, and that really is what swung me to go to that label. You know, it was, well, actually Garland Green and Walter Jackson.
Okay, I'm confused, actually, because Garland Green was doing stuff with Mel Collins and Giant, and
yes,
and then but Walter Jackson was on OK Records, and then
at that time he was working with
and he went
Melvin.
To okay,
yeah. See, Melvin Collins.
So I still don't understand how you got to MGM though.
Mel Collins had Giant Records, but he rarely released anything on Giant.
He did production for other.
He did productions with Willie Henderson.
Okay,
who frequented Giant.
Okay.
Okay, Willie was working with Brownswick.
Yeah.
Okay. And some way they swung a deal. They cut a demo on the Answers. And Willie and Mel swung a deal with MGM.
Okay, so somehow they got hooked up with
they
MGM.
They bid on it, and they gave them about $1.5 million production and promo money for a 45. And that is how we ended up with that huge production.
Okay.
On that particular song.
Well, let me play this song and we could talk a little bit more about
okay.
it. So this is the Answers to Love, and this track is called It Was Real.
Man, look at that lady. Gee, but that lady looks good. But you know, there's something awful familiar about that woman. The more I look at her, the more she reminds me of someone. Yes, she does. The more I look at her, the more she reminds me of someone I knew once in my love. Pardon me, lady, but don't I know you from way back when? Let me see.
Fantastic.
Okay, you're tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM in Chicago. You're listening to the Sitting in the Park show. If you're just tuning in, I'm doing an interview with Eugene Phillips, who was a member of the group The Moments of Truth and who produced and wrote for a bunch of other groups. So that was just The Answers to Love with It Was Real. So we were just talking about how that's the second record that you wrote and produced on The Answers. So, and it got released on Lion Records, which is a division of MGM. So it was a very large, you know, like a major record deal. So what's the story, first of all, between, like, how, why did the group change its name for that record from The Answers to The Answers to Love?
Well, because it's the same thing that the same reason Herb and I changed our name, because the contract with Toy Records initially, they were recorded initially under The Answers and The Answers to Love to avoid any conflicts with Toy Records.
Okay, so
we
you
just stuck the love on the end of the name.
So you changed both the name of the group and your names on the songwriters.
Right. We wrote under Philip Little and Bob Black and Herb Copeland instead of Eugene Phillips, Herbert Cope, and Robert White.
Okay, so that record, it got a lot more distribution and play because it was on...
Well, it didn't get nearly what it was supposed to have gotten. I understand there was some snafu on the promotion end on the Chicago side of it. You know, it would seem like we were pretty much snake-bitten, which actually, that was a tendency in the labels here in Chicago to, well, hey, put it blunt, to rip off major record companies, and they did that.
Okay, so someone who was involved, like, just took the money that was supposed to go
and ran.
To promotion and stuff and ran.
Exactly. They didn't spend the money on promotion. Like I say, this became a notorious habit in Chicago, and it killed the record industry here. I was with the organization. Matter of fact, I was the second president of the Independent Record Manufacturers Association, which is a record organization. Well, we were attempting to stop that kind of a practice in the city because we knew it was killing the industry here. Unfortunately, it's obvious it wasn't very successful.
Okay.
Because all the record companies left.
So you ended up ultimately releasing one more record on The Answers, and this was actually on your own label called Scorpion.
Yes.
So this last record you released was called The Chance That I Take and Thinking of You, and this record you don't even know exactly how many were pressed. It was like a very small number.
No, I don't even really have a clue on it.
So did you form? Why did you formed your own record label for this?
Yes, we did.
So what's the story behind that?
Well, we formed Scorpion in hopes that we could farm out products from our own label and our own publishing company, Black Rose Publishing. Basically, at that time, it was extremely difficult to cut a fine product in Chicago and promote it for under $50,000. You just really couldn't do it. So we cut a great deal of the cost by being writers and arrangers, and we used a very good friend of mine's band, Casey Jones Express,
okay,
who accompanied everything on the rhythm side that we did. He accompanied everything Casey really would give us a break on the cost of...
He had a couple records out himself.
Yes, he did.
So this record that you released, the Chance That I Take and Thinking of You, you were saying you were probably hoping it would get picked up by another label, and it was kind of like a demo.
Precisely.
Okay.
Yeah, that's because we didn't have the money to promote it ourselves, and we were hoping, you know, to attract attention.
Okay.
And unfortunately, again, we attracted the wrong attention.
Okay, so I'll play the record, and then we could talk some more about some of the stuff you did. So this is the last record released by The Answers. This track is called The Chance That I Take. Okay, that was just The Answers with their last record, The Chance That I Take, and I just got to comment on all the records. They had real tight harmony. It's a really excellent sound.
Yeah, they, as a matter of fact, I'm going to tell you a little a quick story about those guys. When we were at Giant Records, they were never allowed to do any cover songs, and they had a show at the Burning Spear, which was located, I think, at 78th and Stony Island at the time. And they wanted to do a cover version of Me and Mrs. Jones, so they did a fantastic arrangement of it. And it was so good until a group actually recorded that. The Me and Mrs. Jones that you hear, I forget the name of the group.
I think you're thinking of the Dramatics version.
The Dramatics are the ones. They were on the show. Matter of fact, The Answers were opening for the Dramatics.
Okay.
And the Dramatics were so impressed by that version until they duplicated it to a T. Joe Council's the leader on the song on the, that they did on the show. And
okay.
The Dramatics asked them if they could just do that actual arrangement. And they did. They did. The Me and Mrs. Jones by the Dramatics was originally done in that exact version by The Answers.
Okay.
Because we wouldn't allow them to record it because, well, it wasn't our song.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like, clearly they were a really talented
group,
and they just never got to, they never really got to have a hit because of everything that happened with the labels. And like you said, they even inspired, you're saying they inspired the Dramatics to
do
their version of Me and Mrs. Jones.
Right.
So, we should talk about, do you know what happened with The Answers? Did they broke up or what happened after that last record?
After the last record, we went, to N&H, and unfortunately, that was a tumultuous time. NNH had a fantastic stable of talent with Windy City and several other acts there. Among those acts was a really real character, Hassan.
This is another record that you wrote.
Yeah,
and
we wrote and arranged, right. That was a record that, you know, how can I got pie in my face on that one for the simple reason I didn't think that they should have put it out. Because Hassan's not a singer. He was a rapper.
Okay.
And this was, you know, before rap.
Okay.
But it hit.
Yeah, it's like a Shaft type.
Right,
type
and it hit. It hit real big. And unfortunately, Jesse Jackson Sr. killed the record, claiming that we were talking about promoting drugs. I don't know where he got that idea from.
Okay, so what happened with this record was you were working with NNH Records,
right.
And then this was one of the artists there, and they asked you to write and produce for him. Is that right?
Right, exactly.
Okay, so I guess I should play the record so people know what we're talking
right,
about. It's interesting.
Right.
So, but I'm still going back. How did the Answers? How did that relate to the Answers breaking up?
Well, what had happened while they were at NNH, the group started to splinter because New Sound was also there.
Okay, that was the other group that you
produced
for.
That was the other group, right. And the Answer started having internal problems, and that's something that basically I didn't tolerate. You know, I mean, hey, we're a family, and when you stop being a family in this business, you should go to, you know, someplace else.
Okay.
And a couple of the guys just weren't getting along, and I explained to them, you know, if you don't get your act together, I'm going to have to cut the group loose because you can't be fighting and there's drugs and all of the trappings that went along with the music industry started to crop up with the Answers.
Okay.
And Gerald moved to Washington and he was the most stable member of the group. He joined the Black Muslims and he was very, very, very well-mannered. He was the only one.
Pretty much the guy who was holding the group together left.
And
then the group broke up.
Yeah.
Okay, well, so we were just talking about how after that you went to NNH Records. How'd you get involved with them?
Well, when we, this is a rather dark period of time. I actually gave birth to New Sound. After the first Answers record, how can I put it? Mel Collins basically abandoned us.
Okay.
And, you know, and he left. He and Walter Jackson and some more entertainers left and went, took some of that money apparently and went down to the Bahamas or somewhere. At any rate, we were left there to run the record label by ourselves with no money and no heat. And winter came on and we were like,
You're talking about Scorps?
No, this was actually Giant.
Okay.
Okay, and what happened, we just abandoned ship. And while we were doing this, you know, the Answers were coming and going, you know, they were beginning to get this little attitude, the big head, like I was saying, with the drugs and so forth. And several of the people were hanging around. Chester, who was a former member of the Answers, says, hey, man, you know, we can form another group, and, you know, we're clean and we're fresh and we're not on drugs and anything like that, you know. And we can, if you and Herb will write for us and arrange for us, we can give you a hit.
Okay.
You know, and so we're like, okay, and basically it was a thing of, you know, the Answers think they're their only show in town. Let's show them that somebody else can take the center stage as well. So, New Sound.
So how does that relate to NNH Records?
Okay, what had happened, we did New Sound independently.
Okay.
At Giant, but we left Giant. And when we left Giant, NNH was starting up.
Okay.
Okay, we went down and we auditioned there. Well, actually,
so the NNH, those are two people's initials, right?
Yes, it's Kenneth Neal and Bill Higgins.
Okay.
Yeah, they were the president or founders of NNH Records. We took our products down there, and they loved it. Well, we had a reputation by that time with Giant Records, so they pretty much knew who we were. It wasn't like we were coming in, you know, green kids on the block.
Okay.
They knew who we were, and they just was like, okay, they embraced us very easily. And we just had some kablotch, so to speak, in regards to being able to produce and write stuff for NNH.
Okay, so the things you wrote and produced, you were talking about how you wrote for this guy, Hassan. And actually, let's play the record before we.
Yeah.
So with the Hassan record you were talking about, it was a guy who couldn't really sing, but he wanted to do a record, and you had to do something for him.
Yeah, right. And this was really just keeping a promise.
Okay,
because
so,
there was no way in the world, you know, I didn't want to do this. No.
So this is like a Shaft type record.
Exactly.
And this is called Ghetto King. So I'm going to play it, and we can talk some more.
Okay.
Okay, that was just an artist named Hassan with a track called Ghetto King that was written, produced by Eugene Phillips, who is up in here now. And you were saying that was one of the things that you did kind of as a favor to the NNH label that you were working with at the time.
Yeah.
So what else did you do for the label?
We did the thing with the actually part of the Answers thing, which was never released. We did that one.
You told me you had worked with Ultra High Frequency.
That wasn't within NNH. That was another group. That was out of Robbins.
Okay.
Frequency was Danny Johnson, who went on to sing with the Shy Lights.
And the Ultra High Frequency, they had that song, We're on the Right Track, right?
I think it was. I can't say for certain on that one. I believe it was. I'm not certain.
Okay. So, but that never got released. And so the final record that you produced, one of the final groups was the New Sound that we were just talking about before.
Yeah, this was before the Wind thing.
Okay, so this New Sound group, you were just talking about how they kind of formed after the Answers broke up with a couple of the original members of the Answers, right?
Right, exactly. Actually, New Sound, like I said, was formed as kind of you know, we can do it too kind of a group. You know, the Answers were very aware of how good they were, and they became rather conceited as a unit. And New Sound was kind of like, oh, okay, they had very little respect because they weren't as tight as the Answers were.
Okay.
But we were like, okay, hey, we can make a hit out of them too, you know.
Okay.
You know.
So this group, the New Sound, you released their record on your own label again, Scorpion.
Yes.
Scorpion Records.
Yes.
So this one came out after the Answers on Scorpion?
Yes, it did, right.
Okay. So you originally released it. This track is called Bet You Never Even Thought About It.
Right.
And actually both sides of this are excellent. Two, and then I guess this record. Well, actually, let me play the record, and we can talk some more.
Oh,
about
okay.
It. So this is the New Sound with their one release record. This is called "Bet You Never Even Thought About It." Okay, that was just the New Sound with their one release record called Bet You Never Even Thought About It. So we were just talking about how that was a group that formed sort of after, like sort of in response to the Answers.
Right, exactly.
So who were the members of the New Sound?
New Sound was Mamie Todd. It was Mamie Cole at the time.
That's a woman?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, that Lloyd Jenkins was the lead singer.
Okay.
Chester Shipp, who was a former singer of The Answers.
And you were saying he was also in the Classettes?
Oh, right. He was also with the he also sang with the Classettes.
Okay.
And all I know is Frog. I never knew Frog's real name.
Okay. So then that there were four members in that New Sound.
Right,
group.
Exactly.
So what's the deal? Like, you recorded that one record on them, and it actually got picked up by another label, right?
Yes, Monarch picked it up, Chuck Sibbett's label. It was successful in regards to, it was critically acclaimed.
Okay.
Billboard picked it to click, and it did well, extremely well on WBON's charts.
Okay.
But again, there's a politic thing, the political situation. We did another, it wasn't a release. We took them back in the studio, and that product was never released. Again, there's the specter of drugs, which eventually took the life of one of the members, and that was Lloyd Jenkins.
Okay.
And he became hooked on drugs.
Okay.
And we couldn't release the other side anyway. And unfortunately, NNH started having financial problems.
But that record, did it have anything to do with NNH?
Yeah, it was the second record was cut on NNH.
But you released it on your own label?
No, we never released the second one.
Oh, you said you released a second New Sound record.
We cut a second
New Sound that was never released.
Right, exactly.
It was supposed to come out at NNH,
exactly.
But it didn't.
It was never released, right.
Okay, so that, and you said the group broke up mainly like internal strife and
right, because there was a thing where Frog started singing with the Answers, and he started fighting with the guys over there.
Do you mean the class set when he was with the class?
No, the Answers.
Okay, he went back
he
to
He sung with the Answers for a moment.
Okay.
And I understand they started having physical strife and conflict, and I just wasn't going to put up with that. So it was like, okay, hey, it's just better you guys, you know, particularly after Gerald left. Gerald said he was leaving anyway and moving to Washington. And the rest of the guys are just too unstable.
Okay, so all this stuff was happening around, like, 74 or sometime.
Right, exactly.
And then the next music thing that you ended up, at least you ended up releasing, was a group called Wind.
So
what was happening in between that time, actually, like from 74? The Wind thing came out around 1980, is that right?
Right.
So what was happening in between that time? Were you still involved with music?
No.
Okay.
No, not at all. The weird thing about that, I was a cab driver. I drove cabs. As a matter of fact, the most notorious cab driver in Chicago.
Okay.
One night I was finishing up a run and picked up a young lady at 71st and Cottage Grove, and she... I guess due to my addiction, she said, you know, she asked me, she says, well, you do more than drive cabs. And I'm like, you know, yeah, you know, what do you do? I said, well, I was a record producer. And she's like, okay, I'm with a new group. You know, we're forming a group and we need somebody to give us some direction.
Okay.
And
so you just stopped. You stopped doing music stuff and you just started driving a cab for a while?
No, I drove cab 20 years. I drove a long time. I was driving when I was producing these groups.
Okay.
That's how I managed to feed myself.
Okay, so you stopped doing the music for a little bit and then...
Yeah.
And then one day a woman in your cab was like, I'm in a group, you want to produce me? Is that...
Yeah, she says, you know, they're new and I didn't want to be bothered. I've been out of the record business for quite a while and I'm like, I really don't want to do this. And she begged so hard. She says, you know, if we... are not good enough, then you can just drop us. And I just deliberately went there to try to see if they would do what I asked them to do. And they were, like, very good students. And they were raw. And
so did they have a name already?
No.
Okay.
No, they didn't.
She was just some woman in your cab, like, we have a group. Will you produce us?
Right. And she was, at that time, she was not a very good singer. And she was aspiring. And I took the group under my wing. And I said, well, okay. And I talked to Herb, and he wasn't hot on doing it either. And I says, well, okay, well, you know, let's give it a shot.
Okay.
And they turned out to be Wind.
So who were the members of Wind?
Oh, gosh, we were a large group. I can't even remember all
of them. So it was a band and a group?
It was a band and singers, right.
Do you remember the singers?
The singers were, let me see if I can start with Thomas Jose Slaughter. Okay, John Savage. Okay,
John Savage, he was in some other groups too.
John Savage sung with Heaven and Earth, Temptations, El Dorados. He sung with a lot of groups.
Okay.
Yeah, he sung with a bunch of groups. Let me see.
Was he one of the Majestic Arrows?
One of the Majestic Arrows as well. Yeah.
Okay. And yeah. I think he was in Special Touch, you were saying?
Yep, Special Touch.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
He was in a bunch.
Okay.
He was an awesome bass singer.
Okay.
You know, awesome. Really, really very good. Let me see. I can't even...
Did you sing on the record, the Wind record?
I was the lead singer.
Okay, so you're the lead. So you started... After, like, 20 years, you're singing on a record again?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, or actually, not more like 15 years.
Well, quite a while.
So I'll play the record, and we can talk a little bit more about it. So this is after sort of a hiatus from music, like 5-6 year hiatus. You got involved with producing a record again around 1980.
Right.
And you produced a group called Wind.
Okay, this particular record I'm not doing the leading on. Matter of fact, the young lady who introduced me to the group is the lead singer on this.
What's her name?
Deborah Burks.
Okay. So I'll play the record and we can talk some more.
Right.
So this is Wind and this track is called Don't Let Them Tell You. Okay, that was just a group called Wind, and that track was called Don't Let Them Tell You. And right now we're talking live to Eugene Phillips, who was a member of the group and who produced the record. So I guess you were telling me that the members of the group singing, at least, are Thomas Slaughter, John Savage, Eugene Phillips, Deborah Burke, and Tyree Bell. Is that right?
Right.
And then Wind was also a band, and there were a bunch of people in the band,
right,
too. So on that record, so what's the deal with that record? It came out on a label called Eclipse.
Well, it actually was never released. That was a test pressing that was given to the Dogs of War just to kind of give a field test to see whether or not, because it was real unorthodox, to see whether or not it would actually do anything. So we did about 300 test pressings, and they distributed the record through the Dogs of War around the country to about 6 states.
Okay.
And it went out with about 9 records. I think we came in number 2. As far as the DJ ratings.
Okay.
And they had informed us that we were having problems with equalization, which is the only reason we didn't come in number 1. Several of the DJs said they couldn't get it mixed properly. But overall, it got an excellent rating. It said it was just a dance record. And So
on that record, the record label, that Eclipse label, it was done with this guy, Errol Brown.
Errol Brown, right, Brown Productions.
So he was the guy who had the Bandit label and did the Majestic Arrows, right?
Right, precisely.
So how'd you get involved with him?
Mr. Brown, I've got to reach way, way, way back to try to figure out how I'm trying to remember how I even became involved. Oh, I can remember how I became involved with Mr. Brown. It was through the Independent Record Manufacturers Association, which Clarence Johnson was the original president.
Okay.
And We had broken away from NNH Records at that time. We had broken away from Giant Records, and we were kind of like a loose cannon, so to speak. And we were regarded as being very good, but we weren't in anybody's camp, so to speak.
Okay.
And they were kind of like splitting up camps. And Mr. Brown kind of took us under his wings as in regards to saying, okay, you guys are really good, but, you know, you need some muscle.
Okay.
You know, behind you. You need a label behind you. And that's how I ended up being with Brown Productions.
Okay. So you guys, you were telling me that you had recorded a whole album with Wind that never got released.
Wind is, yes. We're hoping that some parts of it will be released. It was never released due to, political problems.
Okay. Yeah, it'd be cool to get someone release that.
Yeah, that would really be great. It's because it's, I think it's the tune that we just played, which is we did because it was so unorthodox. We are an Earth, Wind, and Fire type group.
Okay.
Basically, and that was really out of the pocket for us, and that's one reason we wanted to see what it would do.
Okay.
Everything else was like real serious, moody kind of music, real pretty.
Okay.
Ballads, and even the up-tempo stuff wasn't unorthodox like that.
Okay. Yeah, so what happened after that? Like, that was one of the last things you did around 1980. Have you been involved with music since then?
Yes, I did a contemporary gospel album and a contemporary R&B album for a young lady by the name of Deborah Lloyd Brown. And group was called Deborah Lloyd Brown and Company.
Was that released?
No, it was not released. Again, political problems. Deborah Lloyd Brown was living in Robbins at the time, as a matter of fact. This is a gentleman who just called. He might know the Browns because she lived behind Lincoln Memorial School. He would know where that's at. But she no longer resides there. Her and her husband moved out, I think, to Country Club Hills.
Okay.
And but she is awesome. I mean, incredible talent. You know, I really pray to God that we can get a chance to release both her a pop album and her contemporary gospel album. That's one that we internal strife. The album was received fantastically.
Okay.
I mean, awesome reception. The Mighty Clouds of Joy's original, not the original manager, the one that just passed away, was going to take the group under his wings because he was just, you know, wild about the material, because we sung modern jazz harmony.
Okay.
Which is not done that frequently in gospel music.
Yeah, well, I hope something comes of that too, and
yes.
You know, I hope you know, eventually a lot of this stuff is just so excellent, but you didn't have the promotion or distribution that you know, could have made a lot of the stuff big hits. So thanks so much for coming down and telling your story.
It's been a blast. I've really, really enjoyed it. It's just unfortunate they couldn't hear all of them, but the ones they did hear, at least they get an idea.
Yeah, we have a little bit more time, so I guess for the rest of the time I could play some of the other records that we didn't get a chance to play,
okay.
Or some of the other songs.
Okay.
And if anyone has any questions for Eugene, you can call up at 773-702-8424. This next record is the other side of that New Sound record. This is really good. This is called Just One More Time.
Mm-hmm.